Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Faultline Podcast, the audio companion to the weekly B2B publication covering disruption in the media and entertainment ecosystem. In this episode, we are joined by someone who has co-created an IP video company in the image of a multi-headed dog from Greek mythology that guards the gates of the underworld to prevent the dead from leaving. But don't let that put you off, because he's quite friendly, really. Please welcome, all the way from the sunny south of England, Brad Carter, CEO and co-founder at Cerberus Tech. How are you today, Brad?
I'm very well, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And just for the record, this Cerberus Tech is in no way affiliated with Cerberus Technology Solutions, which is an operating subsidiary of the US Capital Management Company. Am I right in saying that?
That is correct. Yes, we are the independent and private limited company of our own.
All right, just wanted to get that out of the way for anyone who saw the title of this episode and was expecting something different.
No, there's surprisingly a lot of Cerberuses, but I will put my hand up and say I did not name the company.
Okay.
I came in slightly a little bit later than the formation of the company, to be fair. So, it's a name that stuck, and, you know, obviously once you build a company and the name's there, it kind of difficult then to change it, But I don't think it's a bad name, really.
If you're not a fan of multi-headed dogs and Greek mythology, I do know what you are a fan of, and this is a great way to start. And because I need to set the scene for our listeners, you know, because we've done, you know, thousands of video meetings in recent years, you know, which has allowed us to peek into people's homes. But Brad, you have a case for the coolest home office backdrop of the bunch, because you've got nearly a life-sized stormtrooper just behind you.
It does fit me. I can wear it to Halloween costume parties, and I have done. It still has some beer and Jack Daniels and Coke all over it, because I'm terrible for cleaning that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's now in the background.
It is awesome. And, you know, there's some other Star Wars memorabilia. And, you know, I understand that there is a fitting story behind these works of art.
There are, actually, yes. I mean, aside from the fact that I'm a super nerd and I love, you know, Star Wars and things like that, we do have a foundation of working in the movie industry as our start as a company. That would have been 9 years ago or so. We got involved with, on-set delivery of IP video, sort of where we got into, you know, the cloud and moving video around. And, fortunately, and, you know, for us, we managed to do that for the likes of Lucasfilm. Really get into the first... I remember getting a call from my co-founder saying, you know, you've got to get here now. This is like 6:30 in the morning. You have to put everything down and drive to this location where he was. And it was somewhere on the border of Wales and England. And I found myself turning up to the set of Episode 7, Star Wars, stormtroopers running around, you know, met J.J. Abrams, you know. Just, it was like, you know, for me, it was like a dream, because... obviously, being a nerd, it was a great sort of start to what we wanted to do. And actually, to be fair, at the time, we were doing a lot of on-set Wi-Fi networking, that sort of the satellite backhaul stuff for those guys. And the inevitable, can you get this video into my trailer, came up. And we went, well, I can get it in your trailer, but I can also get it to you in LA in your house if you want to, you know. So this is sort of the emergence of technologies like Zixi that started to appear, that we started to use. So yeah, it's a good sort of like backstory for us. Not that we do any of that stuff anymore, because we moved into broadcast and that's where we sort of live.
And we'll come on to things like Zixi shortly. But, you know, this is quite interesting timing, Brad, because when we spoke a few weeks ago, you were the CTO and now you're the CEO. So firstly, congratulations on promoting yourself. And second, you know, what's the reason behind this management shakeup and, of course, the shiny new Cerberus Tech logo that unfortunately we can't appreciate through the medium of an audio podcast? But yeah, what's the thinking here?
Yeah, I mean, the logo was a simple one. You know, we tried to build a company on innovation and creativity, and I was at a Sempty event a couple of months ago, and our logo was up on the banner of all of the members of Sempty, and it just looked dull. It looked boring. And, you know, we've been talking about it for a long time, about changing it. And obviously, you know, wanted to keep it in line with our sort of current logo, but just add some color in there. And it was as simple as that. You know, we're a creative company. We should have a nice creative logo. And I've had pretty good positive feedback. So I think we sort of did the right thing on that side of things. And then, yeah, as far as the management structure goes, it's actually been like that for about 6 months. It was one evening, I think it was at MPTS, me and Chris, my co-founder, were having a bottle of wine together in the flat that we were in, and, you know, just talking about growth and building the company up and getting us to that next step. And it was inevitable, really. Just, you know, Chris explains it really well. It's one thing to take a rocket and get it into space. It's another thing to keep it in orbit, right? So it was really about just dividing the responsibilities up again, and, you know, my skill set and his skill set, and it really came down to me being a better fit to run the company side of things and step away, you know, from the technical, not really step away from the technical aspect, because we are a technical company. You know, because we're small, we're not a giant company. You know, we fill a lot of roles, and it's more of a technical CEO role, I think, is probably a better term. It's really hard to put labels on things, because it's fine in a company when you've got hundreds and hundreds of people. You know, you can put labels on people, but for us, you know, somebody's in charge. That's me now. I sit at the top. We've got a management team that sits underneath me, you know, but I still fill roles within that management team, you know, especially around the tech side, the dev side. But it was just a natural evolution for us. It was just a natural growth. We hit that natural growth point, and it was that's what was best to get us to the next level. And Chris won't mind me saying this, but he's terrible at admin, so that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy with the rocket into space. And, you know, when it's with larger companies and you see these management shakeups, and you can assume that, you know, this is part of you know, sweeping layoffs or major staff cuts, but, you know, this is just an innocent rejig.
Yeah, it is a rejig. You know, there's certain aspects in building a business and certain levels you have to get to, and you have to, you know, if you want to keep getting to the next tier, then you need to, you know, be conscious of the fact where your weaknesses are, right? You have to really look at yourself and look at the company and just see, you know, what is best to move that forwards. And that's what we decided to do, and it's working out really well for us. You know, I've never felt that, you know, Cerberus as a company has ever been in a better situation than it is currently.
Great, glad we cleared that up. So moving on to what is normally tradition on the Faultline podcast, which is where we will trawl back through the extensive Faultline archive of thousands of articles on disruption in the video industry, stretching back 21 years. To pinpoint when our guest / company first appeared on the pages of Faultline and came onto our radar. And, you know, personally, you haven't yet featured on the pages of Faultline, Brad. You know, we need to change that. But we first mentioned Cerberus Tech in writing in December 2019, when you just joined up for the RIST Forum at the time. And that came, you know, five and a bit years, you know, since Cerberus was founded in 2014. Of course, you already supported SRT, and then you followed that up by adding Zixi support in 2021, if my timeline is correct. So, you know, that's the big three transport protocols covered, of course. So the key question we all want to know, Brad, is which is your favorite?
It's got to be Zixi. We actually been using Zixi for a long time. It was actually the first one we used. We use Zixi software, Zixi feeders and receivers and broadcasters. Technically wise, Zixi's got to be my favorite. Not necessarily commercially wise. I mean, SRT is free, right? It's a free code, open source code base that we can implement into our stuff, and we can use it. And the interoperability is getting much better, and we're seeing much, much more uptake in the market of people using SRT, constantly, you know, being asked to deliver and receive SRT feeds. So I think it's starting to, you know, make huge, you know, waves, or it's really found its place in the market. Zixi has always been super reliable. You know, it's always been a super reliable technology. And I'm, you know, I'm not talking about all of the bells and whistles that come with Zixi. You know, just if we look at the protocol itself, it's always been the best, right? And it's always, it's never failed. It's never let us down. It's always been great. And then Wrist. Wrist is a good idea. I just don't think it's had the uptake that was really sort of what we saw, you know, or what they thought it might have. Because as we all know, Wrist is a set of standards that we can all follow. I just don't think anyone's really, I think SRT's, you know, I think SRT's just, it's made such huge waves and it's working and, you know, and it does the job. You know, largely down to Peter Mag and Hayvision's marketing, I would say. But it, you know, that's forced everyone to integrate, and it's forced everyone to, you know, put that solution in. It's not without its issues, and that, you know, they're well documented. You can go and see them on GitHub and see what the issues are, and there are big issues with it, especially with the sort of historical debt in the code base. But yeah, I mean, back to your question, Zixi's always, you know, for me, is the most reliable, you know, but SRT is close up behind now, I think.
Do you think there's scope for consolidation of these protocols, or will we continue to see fragmentation? You know, we've got LRT entering the scene as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, everyone's going to try and make something, right? I think, you know, people are going to try and look, I mean, it's not like it's something insanely special or unique, right? I mean, it's ARQ plus FEC, right? Like, ARQ's been around forever and FEC's been around forever, right? And yes, Zixi have their own proprietary FEC, and, you know, Wrist's trying to use the 70 standards, but it's, people are going to try and do their own thing, and that's going to work, you know, end to end with their own pieces of kit. Sure, it's going to work. Of course it is. That, you know, it's the interoperability problem, right, that's going to cause issues, I think, because it already does. You know, you implement Zixi in a piece of kit, let's call it like a, you know, an encoder, you use their SDK, you know what you get in the SDKs and SDK, you know, you implement SRT. Well, you know, hopefully everyone's using the, well, not everyone's going to use the open source codes, you know, something. I know of people implementing their own version of SRT, but it's going to come down to, is it interoperable with the other pieces of kit? Because that's what we want, right? That's what we want. We don't want to have to send kit out into the field, or we don't want to have to send kit to people to pick up a feed. We want to just say, oh, send us an SRT feed or send us a Zixi feed, right? Like, it should be as simple as that these days. There shouldn't be any complexity in that. But yeah, there's going to be other standards coming. There's been other standards in the past, you know. There was that, I think it's called Relaycaster. I don't know if you know about that one. I think Roden Sports bought it in the end, but that was sort of seen, or maybe was seen to be sort of the next big sort of Zixi competitor, but I don't know where they are now. I've not heard of them since NA 4 years ago. But yeah, but the point is that, yeah, there's always going to be competition, and competition's healthy, right? Of course it is. We push standards, we push things if there's good competition. But I don't know if we're going to be able to push, you know, I don't think SRT's going anywhere. I think SRT's only going to get bigger. You know, it works and people are using it. You know, unless, I mean, there's low latency, you know, TCP protocols coming in, and that's going to be the market, really. If something good does come in, you know, if we can get that right, then great. It's interesting time. It's a really interesting time from a tech sort of point of view.
So you guys, you started out on AWS, deploying AWS EC2 instances back in 2014. That's where it all began, I understand. And, you know, AWS is kind of effectively a reseller for Zixi. And around the same time, Zixi's UK reseller went out of business. And Cerberus was then able to slide in as Zixi's official reseller for the UK and parts of Western Europe. Two. So is there a kind of element of, you know, serendipity or maybe even luck about some of Cerberus's success? Or does, you know, implying that, does that just do a damn right injustice to the work you've put in and the products you've created?
No, I think with any business, you know, you've got to put hard work in, but there's got to be an element of luck that has to be. You know, you just, if it's not being at the right place at the right time, it's at least making the right decisions at the right time. And I just think it's natural. It's not unique to the broadcast industry at all, but I think it's just business full stop. There's got to be an element of luck. And we were lucky. We started the business, and when we went into the broadcast industry, we tried to go after sort of the tier three content providers because we thought maybe that's where we're going to fit in. But, you know, with falling into relationships with Zixi, we got in the doors of the big tier ones, and that's where we've been ever since, you know. So yeah, 100% there's a bit of luck there. I think anybody who's ever started a successful business will say the same thing.
That's a shame. I was kind of hoping you were going to disagree with me and say, how dare you imply such a thing?
No, I mean, look, I'm not going to say that I haven't spent, you know, the last 9 years of my life working as hard as I can possibly work, you know. I mean, I'd hate to think at the end I'd never, you know, I hadn't have put as much effort in as I could have possibly put in, you know, successful or not successful. At least I did as much as I could. So there's been a lot. There's been plenty of late nights, plenty of late all the way through the nights to the next morning, you know, during this journey. But there's always a bit of luck. There has to be, you know.
Absolutely. So looking at the sort of cloud and multi-cloud approaches to IP video delivery, are you now finding, you know, that customers are regretting decisions to be sort of wedded to, you know, AWS now more than ever, you know, primarily because of, you know, we have these insane and often unexpected, you know, cloud computing bills coming in, and then how difficult is it to then, you know, decouple this reliance on single cloud providers from your perspective?
Yeah, I definitely seen the requests come in for multi-cloud use, or, you know, detachment from that single one-use cloud. I liken the analogy to building a house, right? AWS and GCP and, you know, all any cloud provider, public or private, right? They are the B&Qs, the Home Depots of the world, right? They are the place you go and get the materials to build your house. They are not house builders, right? And if one place is offering something that is more expensive than the other, then you take a view on whether you want to go to the cheaper option or the more expensive option, and you have to understand why you make that decision, right? But a house builder is a house builder, and if, you know, look, I'm not a house builder, I'm not in construction, but to me, a piece of wood's a piece of wood, right? Like, if I'm going to go and get a, you know, 3 meter long 2x4 from B&Q and it's going to cost me, you know, £3, and then I can go to Wix's and get the same piece of wood for £1.60, then why wouldn't I go to the, say, you know, Wix's and save myself some money? And I liken the cloud providers to that because, you know, it is just that it's a tool set and a facility to build whatever you want to build. And we took from day one the decision to decouple ourselves from the reliance on any one cloud provider, you know, and it's why we can deploy all of our resources into multiple clouds. And, you know, we support multiple clouds now. Yeah. And it is as simple as choose what cloud provider you want to put it in. Whatever we deploy in each one is exactly the same as what we put in the other. We don't, you know, we're not reliant then on one single cloud provider. We're not reliant on the fact that, you know, we have to get stuck with these huge egress bills or these huge, you know, EC2 for Amazon or these compute bills, right? Because there are other options. And I think, you know, AWS is a fantastic cloud provider as far as the reliance is concerned. They're super reliable. Their compute power, their compute is super reliable. But there are other cloud providers out there, and I think you know, largely our industry has gone into this a bit blind because they've been forced into it so quickly that they've just gone with the biggest provider and they've basically thought that that provider will build the house for them, whereas they've now come to realize that actually they've had to build the house themselves, and it's a bit janky and it's a bit rickety and it's a bit, you know, it's not really what they wanted. And now there's this sort of backpedaling to, oh, maybe we need to go back on-prem because it actually might be a cheaper option, which I'm hearing about, you know. But they've not even explored the other cloud providers. You know, there is a ton of other cloud providers out there. You know, we can leave AWS and GCP and, you know, even people like Oracle Clouds, you know, they're so much cheaper, you know, and that's a big cloud provider still. You know, I think we talked about this before, but we use DigitalOcean, which is like, I guess, the next tier down. Yes, you can't get access to as much compute and the same sort of resource, but you can balance it off and you can, you know, you can plan ahead, especially for live, you know, 24/7 sort of distribution services. And it's a tenth of the cost, you know. So, you know, it's
wow.
It makes a huge amount of difference, especially when you're running 24/7 services, right? I think people just need to look at different options, you know, that there are other options out there. And that's why we tried to build ours. That's why we have built ours, you know, decoupled from the cloud. And you know, we've chosen AWS because that's where we started. We chose GCP because we were doing some work with Google. And we chose DO because we needed a cheaper option to run managed 24/7 distribution. But our model can be applied to any cloud provider. You know, within a couple of weeks, we could integrate another cloud provider, anyone that anybody wanted to work with, private or public cloud. It is as simple as that. And that's kind of how we've tried to do it, you know.
10 times cheaper. Yeah, that's absolutely massive. I didn't realize it was at that sort of scale. But right, it's case study time, Brad. So you were recently up in Scotland on site with a sports production company called QTV, which is covering Scottish Professional Football League fixtures, that's soccer for our American audience, and had been tasked with delivering 142 live matches to the likes of BBC Scotland, Sky Sports, club OTT channels, and Cerberus's LiveLink platform has been a key part of this. So can you tell us a bit more about this particular project, please?
Yeah, so we've been working with QTV for a number of years now. They use our LiveLink platform, which is for users that don't know, it's our software as a service, essentially our software as a service platform. And they're completely self-serve. They do everything themselves. We don't get involved. They, you know, we're there obviously as a, you know, technical support should they require it, but it's very rare. And basically they bring, you know, on a match day, they bring all the feeds into the clouds. We have the ability to spin up transcoders. So they transcode each of those matches to varying bit rates. They also do frame rate conversions on those feeds that come in for the US market. And then they deliver them to, you know, mostly domestic takers like the BBC and Sky and Stats Perform for the statistics side, and to their editing platforms for their editors as well. So, you know, the nice thing about what we have is that they can shut everything down after a match. Everything gets collapsed. It's no longer exists. They can press one button and everything gets rebuilt for them, and it's all there ready to go for a live match day, and they can schedule all of their feeds to go live when they want it to go live. So yeah, we've got a really nice use case with those guys and the way they use the platform.
All right, great. And I'm glad you mentioned SaaS, because, you know, we've been, you know, tracking the kind of SaaS revolution, the transition to SaaS at various companies. You know, looking at, you know, Harmonic's latest results, for example. You know, I know Harmonic is in the process of shifting its video division, but this is a case in point that, you know, SaaS revenues, because it's a publicly listed company, SaaS revenues have been climbing, and in the last quarter they accounted for over 30% of total net revenue from the video division. So I kind of wondered, you know, what sort of proportion of Cerberus's business is coming from, you know, managed services and SaaS today. I don't know if you can give us an idea, because, you know, I understand that quite a significant amount comes from, you know, essentially handling broadcasts on behalf of clients who, you know, don't really have a scooby how any of this stuff really works.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we have a self-service platform, which is SaaS. You know, we also use that platform for managed services. And, you know, that's everything from OU feeds, you know, BT tower pickups, you know, uplinks, downlinks, that sort of stuff, to, yeah, the 24/7 sides of linear distribution. Yeah, so all of our, but basically everything we do goes through this, through a SaaS platform. So, you know, we split it up by, you know, the managed service aspect. You know, some of our users can't or don't want to do it. Maybe they've got, you know, problems with staffing and they need to, you know, they just don't have the staff to look after it. That's kind of where we come in sometimes. Or they just want the, you know, the managed service, they want that 24/7 somebody to look after it for them or give them, you know, our expertise on live video. But everything we do has, you know, that it all gets pushed through the Live Link platform. So technically most of our revenue comes from SaaS. If you look at it in that light, I mean, we could split it up, you know, managed services and live events and then self-serve from customers doing things themselves. We do have a small element of resale. You know, we do represent a few companies, and that's really sort of relationships we fell into because we were using their equipment and it was easier for us to be able to resell the stuff on. But yeah, I would say if you look at it like what goes through Live Link, the SaaS platform, it accounts for probably 90% of what we do now. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we started off in the cloud. We started off using, you know, IP over public internet, and that's what we do, right? We bring stuff into the cloud and we process it in the cloud and we push it on from there. So everything we do is in that sort of model.
Yeah. That's massive. I didn't expect it to be that high. And, you know, the likes of Harmonic and, you know, Cinemedia and MediaKind.
But these guys have got big hardware. They've got big hardware divisions, right? They're still selling decoders and stuff. And we don't, you know, we do get involved in that, but it's all software based, you know, and it's the Atem Titans of the world, right? Like it's a software based product, which makes our life so much easier because we can get somebody on board on Live Link in minutes and we can get them up and running. I think the fastest we ever did a delivery was from engagement of conversation to delivery was sub 10 minutes because it's there, it works. There's no smoke and mirrors. It's there. We built it. You know, we don't lie about what we can do. It. You can go and click up. You can spin 100 transcoders up if you want. There's no, you know, it's ready to go. So, but, you know, we don't want to be having to, you know, source kit and send it somewhere and it's going to take a few months to get there or whatever. No, we just find yourself a server, install the software, here's the license key, let's go. You know, we want to be fast, we want to be agile, because that's the world we live in, right? Every other industry can do it. Why can't we? So, you know, luckily I come from a non-broadcast background. So I come from an industry where things get done. They're fast and they're agile and, you know, that's what we should be doing as well. But we've got the tech to do it. There's some fantastic tech out there and it's there to be used. Mm-hmm. I just think, you know, it's inevitable that it's going to go SaaS, right? I mean, why would you want to keep buying kit? You know, why would you want to keep buying servers that you have to refresh every 3 to 5 years? You know, why not use a cloud provider that's going to refresh the kit for you? They're paying for the electricity and the cooling and all of the stuff that comes with it. And you just pay a monthly fee, you know, $50 for a compute instance, $100, you know, whatever you need. But it's one fee. And if you don't want it anymore, you've got no commitment. You just turn it off and walk away, right? But you're buying stacks of server, you know, server equipment for your rack room, and you know, at some point you're going to have to fork out another X amount of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to refresh that at some point. Right. And it's your problem when it goes wrong, at least in the cloud, you know, you can, you know, that let's face it, there are issues, the same issues that you get in a rack room, but you can spin it down, spin it up on new resource, or they'll port it across for you automatically if a server fails, right? You know, so I don't see why the world wouldn't go that way, you know, but I think the price thing comes into mind with AWS because people think it's the only option when it's not.
Yeah, for sure. With that said, do you see a future in the coming years where Cerberus is 100% SaaS-based business, or will you always have that sort of 10%, 5% non-SaaS supplementary revenue?
Yeah, I think we're always going to have it because we can, you know, and I'd rather supply customers, if they want that stuff, they're the best that we can supply them, you know, instead of them sourcing some, you know, Chinese encoder that's only supports AAC audio and one channel or something. You know, at least we can give them a proper broadcast grade solution if they require it, you know. So I don't, you know, and because it's all software, it's really licensing that we get involved with, you know, it's supplement of the licensing, because you know, anybody can find a Supermicro server or a Supermicro reseller pretty easily. From what we've found, they can get hold of a Dell or a, you know, whatever server they need to get hold of. Stick a capture card in, off you go. Mm-hmm. Stick the software on, you know, license it, and we're off to the races, you know. And when we've done that so many times, you know, even we've even remoted in, get it online, we'll remote in, we'll install the software, we'll put the license on there, we'll set it up for you, and we can do it in, you know, 20 minutes. We'll get one of the engineers to do it, and it's done. So, yeah, I think we'll always get involved in that because it sort of benefits us. I do think the figures might sway the more we do, you know, through the platform with the SaaS side. For sure, you know, because that's our aim. We want to grow our products. We want to grow that base. You know, we're introducing, you know, tons and tons of new products constantly into the platform. So we're just growing that, you know, growing what the capabilities are that we can do.
These are just crazy fast times talking about it. But, you know, sorry for stating the obvious, but, you know, I think, of course, Cerberus is, you know, obviously keenly interested in, you know, the ingress and egress data. And I suppose that's because you're not, you know, simply transferring data into the cloud in a sort of typical manner, I suppose. And of course, that brings us to the question of, you know, having pre-configurations, particularly around setting up security. I know Cerberus prides itself on, you've mentioned price, reliability, speed, but what about security?
It's funny this, because I was at the DB the other day. And someone, and I'm not going to mention names, but there was a talk about a certain provider having a security compromise in their on-premise systems, and somebody managed to log in with some hacked credentials, or the credentials were leaked, and they managed to add themselves a sysadmin and infect the entire network, right? And then the comment was made of, but our cloud services were okay because AWS's security is better, right? Or something, I'm paraphrasing, right? But that's something along those lines. And it's not, right? AWS security is no better. I mean, physically, yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, they've got lock and key on everything, right? But it's about how you implement security, right? Like, it's your security policies and how you implement that. So security-wise, yeah, like, you've got to use best practices, and, you know, there's plenty of information out there of how to do it. You know, most of the big guys know how to do it, sure, you know, but even if you're a one-man band or a startup and you're starting in the cloud, there's plenty of information out there about best use security policies and, you know, how you need to do things and how you need to set stuff up. But that's not, you know, just in AWS. You can do it in all the cloud providers, right? Like, or any, even on your on-prem stuff, it should be the same, you know, the same security policies that apply. That there obviously are differences with cloud and on-prem, because you've got, you know, physical security on-prem to worry about. But, you know, at least in the cloud, you should have security policies in place. You should have, you know, tiered access, you know, different types of access. You should only access the stuff that you're working on, you're required to access. We could go into this for like 3 hours, but I think it really comes down to, you know, best practices and how you implement that. And that should be no different. You know, a server's a server, whether it's cloud running or it's on premise, right? You need to just make sure that, you know, those access policies and those access keys and, you know, the user level access is there, you know, however you do it, but you need to do it, you know, in the right way.
All right. On a final note, Brad, a final question. You know, I like to use the podcast as an opportunity to kind of peer at the people behind the products that we don't get to do on the pages of Faultline. And I understand that before, you alluded to it earlier, actually, before getting your hands dirty with IP video engineering, you were in the military engineering game. So was being a systems engineer for the Royal Air Force as exhilarating slash terrifying as it sounds?
I don't know. It's hard. I mean, it was a long time ago now. But look, I joined up at 17. I really enjoyed my time. I did deploy overseas. I spent some time in Afghanistan. That was more scary than I was expecting being in the Air Force. You know, that's another story. But yeah, I mean, look, it was a great adventure. It was a great time. It gave me the values that, you know, I hold dear today. You know, it gave me the work ethic. It shaped me into the person I was, because I wrote a nice little blog about this the other week. But I was a bit of a laid back. I was a bit of a bum, you know, like I sort of just swung through life, you know, up to the point of joining up. And I ended up sort of catching myself out in some exams that I did and almost got booted out. And sort of that gave me that drive to knuckle down and get on with things. It gave me, I had a passion for engineering anyway, but the real passion came out at that point, because ever since that happens, I've always been super interested in that end-to-end like system flow. I want to know everything about everything. I want to know how everything works. So I've always, you know, wanted to do that, but it's, you know, it's inherently ingrained in me now, like, you know, and it was really down to my time in the Air Force, you know. It was a brilliant time in my life, you know, a really good time in my life. It was never something I planned to stay in. I wasn't going to make a career of it. You know, I left because I saw more opportunity to sort of delve deeper into engineering as a contractor, and leaving and working as a contractor for the MOD, which is what I did, and still deployed quite a lot to the Middle East. But I had free rein at that point to understand the systems in and out and do what I wanted and sort of get deep, because there was no one else there. You know, I had a job where there was no one to ask, really. It was a case of figuring it out yourself and getting on with it. It did surprise me a lot when I joined the broadcast industry and the weight of, you know, a channel going off air and the panic in people's faces, because I was dealing with life and death comms. You know, it was life and death. You know, the comm systems we were providing, the back calls and the networking, it was real world stuff. You know, like, we had to have comms links up because we needed to get information back to the UK and you know, for the defence, and it's real stuff, right? You know, and for me, it's like, well, that is life or death comms. You don't sleep for 3 days until you get it working again if something breaks, because it is life or death, you know. And it's so important at that point. And then I came to the broadcast industry, and it's like, well, it's just a TV signal. And I know a lot of people would probably shoot me for that, right? But, you know, I think if everyone was honest with themselves, you must think to yourself, yeah, right, it is just TV, right? So, and not that we don't put importance on it. Obviously, we look after our channels and we look after our customers. But, yeah, it did give me a sort of a different aspect or a different look on it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely a bit of perspective. And, you know, I read that blog article that you mentioned. I think you described yourself as cocky. Of course, you don't come across as cocky or arrogant at all today. And, you know, I get the impression that it was one of those things that you were glad you did it, but you don't miss it.
No, and I don't think I would be here if I hadn't have had that experience. You know, if I hadn't have had the experience, and, you know, for people that haven't read it, basically the short story is I failed an exam and they, you know, I got a resit and I thought I'd be fine. I ended up resitting and failing it again. And I can tell you exactly, by the way, what that was. It was a subject called MRST, Microwave Radar Specialist Techniques. And it was on a TWT traveling wave tube. And that was what I failed the exam on explaining what a traveling wave tube did and how it worked. And I can tell you how that works right now. Because
I bet you can.
Because I got hauled in front of my group captain and he chewed me out. And he basically told me he was going to kick me out of the Air Force because, you know, they didn't need me. And I pleaded and I managed to get a one time only next shot. And if I failed it again, I was out. And I studied. And I wouldn't have got past my finals if I hadn't have studied, because the finals were insane. Like, we were talking component level fault finding on massive transmitters. It was, you know, pages, books and books of like circuit diagrams that we had to learn inside and out. And, you know, if I hadn't have done that, I would have never got this far. And I'm glad I did. You know, I'm glad I had that experience and needed that young cockiness to be knocked out of me. I just wouldn't have had the right attitude going through life if not, you know. Don't get me wrong, I'm still silly and I still enjoy myself. You know, I'm a surfer. I kite surf. I do rock climbing. It's like my passions that I do, and I do them quite regularly. And I, you know, I'm still a, you know, like to be a child, especially playing around with the kids and stuff. But I think that you have to understand time and place, right? And I just never really understood the time and place. So
that's a really nice place to wrap up with a few little life lessons. So yeah, thanks so much for joining us today, Brad. That was great. Actually, with a closing remark, have you got any travel arrangements, you know, lined up for the near future? Where can people find you or the Cerberus team for a demo, or, you know, just to talk about Star Wars or kite surfing?
Yeah, I mean, you can get me on LinkedIn. You can email me, brad@cerberus.tech. The guys are going out to Madrid for Sportel, is it, I think, in Madrid. We will be actually exhibiting at NAB this year for the first time, which will be interesting. So we've got a shared stand there. So that's a little bit of a new news.
Who are you sharing with?
I was sharing with OBE, Open Broadcasts.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So Kieran and his lot. So we'll be there. If anybody ever wants a demo, hit me up on email or LinkedIn. We can set you up in a couple of minutes. No messing around. Get you using, get you playing. I'm always around, especially to chat about Star Wars.
Yes, especially, yeah. Well, yeah, we'll definitely see you at NAB in April then, Brad. So yeah, thanks again for talking to us. That was a great chat, and thanks to everyone for listening. So yeah, cheers again.
Yeah, thanks guys, thanks for me. Cheers.